Bonsoir tout le monde, good evening. Mon nom est Will Strauss, je suis directeur de l'Institut d'études canadiennes à McGill. On behalf of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, I would like to welcome you to the 2012 Mallory Lecture. I'll just say a few things before I ask Dean Manfredi to talk about the J. Mallory Lecture series in general. But first, I'd like to just remind you that the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada holds a major conference each year. And this year, our conference is going to focus on the theme of crime. It's scheduled for March 15th and 16th. It's actually going to be in the faculty club. And the full title is Crime and the Law, the Future of Justice in Canada. And it has to do with issues of policing, sentencing, and the larger question of the justice we need in Canada. A whole series of events from the introduction of the federal government's omnibus crime bill through new forms of urban protest like the Occupy movement have put policing and justice at the center of public attention. And indeed, tonight's lecture takes up themes related to this. So I invite you to check our website, www.mcgill.ca/MISC, for information on the conference. We'll be going live with registration and full program very soon. But I'll ask now the Dean of Arts, Chris Manfredi, to say a few words about the Mallory Lecture.
Merci, Will. Et comme Will a dit, je suis Christopher Manfredi, doyen de la Faculté des Arts à McGill, et je suis très heureux de vous souhaiter la bienvenue ce soir. I'd like to share a little bit of information with you about J.R. Mallory and the Mallory Lecture. J.R. Mallory was a professor of political science, like me when I get to do that. He was born in 1916 in St. Andrews, New Brunswick, and was educated at New Brunswick, Dalhousie, and Edinburgh. His career took him to Saskatchewan, Toronto, Brandon, and finally McGill, where he served for 45 years and was chairman of the Economics and Political Science Department for 10 years. After retiring in 1982, he was appointed professor emeritus and continued to teach for another 10 years. Professor Mallory passed away in 2003. The endowment for the J.R. Mallory Lecture in Canadian Studies was established in January of 1995. J.R. Mallory himself gave the inaugural lecture, and since then, the Mallory Lecture has featured such renowned speakers as Brooke Carrier, John Meisel, Bob Ray, Warren Almond, Sylvia Ostrey, Peter White, Phyllis Lambert, Pat Armstrong, Alain Dubuc, David Smith, Tom Kent, John Gomery, Chantal Hébert, and last year, Andrew Cohen. As has been the tradition for so many years, we are happy to have Professor Mallory's son, Charles, here, along with Charles's wife, Dorothy Levine. I know that you will enjoy this year's Mallory Lecture, and without further delay, let me ask Will to come back up and introduce this year's speaker.
Thank you, Chris. Well, I would indeed like now to introduce tonight's speaker. I just want to begin by thanking my predecessor at the Institute, Antonio Maione, who, when I took over the job in the summer, said that I really had to meet this remarkable woman, Marlene Jennings, and that if we were lucky, we might actually get her to come and spend some time with us at the Institute. So I did meet her. We had a very nice lunch. I think she used the word, and I agree, we clicked. Bonded over all kinds of things in our past, like Anglicanism and cigarettes and things like that. But I was delighted when she agreed to join MISC for a year as a special visitor. I'll speak in a minute about her rich list of accomplishments, but I want to just say right now how much I've enjoyed Marlene's energy, her sharp and irreverent and I think legendary sense of humor. Ken Dryden said to me, she's got a great sense of humor, doesn't she? And her capacity to act very quickly on ideas and get things done. Indeed, getting to know her over the last few months has been one of the great pleasures of my time at MISC so far. The Honorable Marlene Jennings is a lawyer by profession and a former member of Parliament. For 14 years, she represented the federal riding of Notre-Dame-de-Grâce, Lachine, and during her terms of office, she filled several positions of note. parliamentary secretary to the Prime Minister, with a special emphasis on Canadian-US relations, parliamentary secretary to the Solicitor General, parliamentary secretary to the Minister for International Cooperation. She also held the position of Deputy House Leader for the Official Opposition and Liberal Justice Critic. She was known for her ardent advocacy for civil marriage rights for same-sex couples, for gender equality, corporate social responsibility, affordable housing, to name but a few issues. The Honorable Marlene Jennings is also a recognized expert on issues of good governance, civilian oversight of law enforcement, strengthening Parliament. She has co-founded several organizations, such as the Canadian Association for Civil Oversight of Law Enforcement, the Black Community Resource Center, the McGill Black Students Union. She now sits on the board of directors of Mab McKay Rehabilitation Center, on the Quebec Community Group Network's Nominations Committee, and in 2012 January, that's now, she'll be joining the board of directors of l'Institut Universitaire de Gériatrie de Montréal. She is currently a special visitor, as I said, at MISC, and she is the recipient of the Prix de Reconnaissance 2011, awarded by the Université du Québec à Montréal, Département de Sciences des Sciences Juridiques. I invite you to join me in welcoming the Honorable Marlene Jennings.
Good evening, everyone. I have to begin with my thanks to McGill University, to Dean Manfredi, to Dr. Antonio Maione for introducing me to Dr. Will Smith. Straw. I always say Smith, but it's Straw. Some really good people have the name Smith. I want to thank them for welcoming me to McGill University, which is, you know, a renowned institution here in Canada and worldwide. But my very special thanks and gratitude goes to the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada and its wonderful director, Dr. Will Straw. I got it right this time. My daughter told me, because I practiced my speech in front of her, and she said, you have to be a little bit more animated, and you have to, you know, try to be humorous at times to engage the audience. Don't just keep your eyes on the paper. And I'm thinking, here's this 19-year-old telling me what to do when I've been giving speeches all my life. I started when I was very young. We actually have pictures of it. Anyways, thank you, Ann Darla. I'd also like to thank Dr. Straw's very efficient staff, Joanne Bilodeau, Noran El-Hakim, Petros, and former employee Thomas Tucci, who's gone off to do a stage at the Bill Clinton Foundation. So it just goes to show what MISC can lead to. So I'm expecting great things for myself. I have to say I've enjoyed my visit with MISC largely due to the team's energy, its efficiency, and its generous welcoming of me as a temporary but very visible member of the team. When Dr. Straw invited me to deliver the 2012 J.R. Mallory Lecture, I have to admit I was surprised. And I became more and more intimidated as I did my research about the previous lecturers of the J.R. Mallory Lecture. I mean, to join the company of the people that Dr. Straw, Will mentioned, the Alain Dubuc, the Chantal Hébert, you may have mentioned it. Okay, Chris Manfredi mentioned it. Listen, my memory isn't great, but I say that I have a teenage memory. Whenever you ask a teenager to do something, they say yes, and then they promptly forget to do it. So I always say I'm having a teenage moment, not a senior's moment, and I welcome those of you who suffer those moments to use the expression teenage moment. So I was quite intimidated because my predecessors or precursors are household names and they're nationally recognized experts in their field of endeavor. But I decided to take the challenge because I like challenges. I, on the other hand, may or may not enjoy certain public notoriety, primarily due to my 14 years as a Member of Parliament for the NDG Lachine and Dorval riding. I would humbly submit, though, that the recognition is sparse and limited, and I think that, and it's primarily centered on the residents of my former riding. And then again, given the results of the May 2nd general election, when I bit the dust like a lot of my former colleagues, even there, my notoriety may be overblown. All of this to state that my predecessors have set a high standard in delivering the J.R. Mallory Lecture, and you will be the judge at the end of my speech or lecture as to whether or not I have met that standard. I hope I do. So my topic, as you all know, is entitled An Anatomy of Good Public Policy Gone Bad, A Case Study of Gun Control. Allow me to take a few more moments to outline the principal points of my address. The first part of my lecture will summarize salient points. Oh, this is like the opera in New York. The cell phone that went off and interrupted. I would ask everyone, put your cell phones on vibration or on silence. If you put it on vibration, you know something's come in so you can check it. And if it's important, then you can step out to answer it. Thank you. So the first part of my lecture will summarize salient points of the history of gun control in Canada. I've decided that it's quite important that I give you a brief summary because I've also discovered that too many people here in Canada who hold very strong views in favor or in opposition to the issue of the long gun registry don't in fact know very much about the history of gun control in Canada. And my view is that how can one take a stance in favor or in opposition to any public policy if one doesn't have the actual basic facts of the policy, where it came from, how it evolved, and where it is now. So I'm going to give you that brief history. The second part of my lecture will describe some very well-established principles that inform and go a long way to ensuring that public policy will be effective, efficient, and sustainable. In other words, that it will be good public policy. For the third part, I will describe the Liberal government's process of elaborating its public policy on strengthening gun control in Canada when it first came to power in 1993. This process led to the Firearms Act of 1995 that created the Long Gun Registry, or included long guns in the already existing centralized registry. I will conclude with some of my own suggestions as to which lessons future governments that may be thinking about revisiting gun control and possibly reinstating the long gun registry in its entirety or some elements thereof, because I'm assuming that the Conservative government will be successful and will in fact abolish the long gun registry and may in fact prevail in the court case about destroying the data as well. One hopes that they do not prevail on the data part. So, before I start, I'm going to grab some water. So it doesn't fit there. So, allow me to begin by describing the history and evolution of gun control in Canada. In 1892, Canada's Criminal Code created offenses for selling pistols to someone under the age of 16 years. The code at that time also established the requirement of a permit to carry a pistol unless the owner had cause to fear assault or injury. And there were penalties that attached for violating the mandatory permit requirements. In 1892, the code also created the requirement of vendors to record all purchases of handguns. The vendors had to record the purchaser's name, the date of the sale, and provide a brief description of the handgun that was purchased. Step forward to 1934. Canada established a law, enacted a law, establishing our very first firearm registry, but it was for handguns only. The registration of handguns under the law required the owner's name and address and a description of the handgun. That law also stipulated that the RCMP or other police forces designated by their appropriate provincial attorney general would be legally authorized to keep the records and to issue the registration certificates. Now, my surprise was to learn that between 1939 and 1944, the federal government adopted legislative measures that required mandatory registration of long guns, rifles, and shotguns. Most people don't know this. I've had basic military training as part of a summer job. Yeah, Will's eyebrows just went up. At the Black Watch Armory, it was a summer job, couldn't find a job, joined the reserves for the summer and did 10 weeks basic training, learned how to, you know, strip and assemble an FN-16, a semi-automatic rifle, learned how to, you know, shoot the bazooka, the rocket launchers. I had really good aim with the rocket launcher, really lousy aim with the semi-automatic. That speaks to my character clearly. So, I want to repeat, between 1939 and the end of the Second World War, long guns were subject to mandatory registration. So people who thought that the Liberal bill, C-68, created something new were wrong, and I was one of the people that was wrong. It was scrapped, as I said, at the end of the war, and that spelled the first death of Canadian mandatory registration of long guns, of rifles and shotguns. In 1951, the year of my birth, for anyone who's interested, we saw automatic weapons added to the category of firearms requiring mandatory registration. The registry system that was created 17 years before was finally centralized under the authority of the Commissioner of the RCMP. This means that Canada's first centralized registry was created over 60 years ago. However, because the mandatory registration of long guns was scrapped after the Second World War, long guns were not part of that centralized registry system. In 1969, the federal government introduced and Parliament adopted Bill C-450. This law created restricted categories of restricted and non-restricted weapons. It also introduced protections for owner by establishing the requirement of a judicial warrant for the search and seizure of firearms by police officers. Now let's move to the next significant strengthening of Canada's gun control policies, and that was 1977 when Bill C-51 was adopted. It created the Firearm Acquisition Certificate, or FAC, F-A-C, as it is commonly called. It also created the mandatory requirement that any person wishing to acquire a firearm had to be the holder of this certificate, and the issuance of the FAC required successfully passing a basic criminal background check by the police. C-51 also created controls on the selling of ammunition and classified fully automatic weapons as prohibited. And now we come to 1991. In the aftermath of the horrific and tragic events of Polytechnique in Montreal, the Progressive Conservative government, which was in power at the time, acted quite quickly to strengthen our then existing gun control policies. That government introduced and had adopted by Parliament Bill C-17. This legislation was intended to significantly reinforce the then existing gun control policies in Canada, and it sought to do so by bringing forth the following measures. First, the gun control laws would now require that all firearm acquisition certificate applicants successfully pass a firearm safety course. Secondly, each applicant would be required to undergo a much more thorough background check. And finally, it also created a mandatory minimum wait period of 28 days prior to the issuance of an FAC by the authorized police force. However, Bill C-17 went further. It also established much stricter restrictions and controls on any firearms with a military or paramilitary appearance. It created new restrictions on the ownership of high-capacity magazines, and it limited handguns to a maximum capacity of 10 rounds, and most semi-automatic rifles were now restricted to a maximum capacity of 5 rounds of ammunition. Given the opposition of some provinces, the federal government also included opt-out provisions for the provinces in Bill C-17. We now reach the year of 1995 and the adoption of Bill C-68, the legislation that for the second time in Canadian gun control history created mandatory registration of long guns. Now, keep in mind that all of the provisions of its predecessor, Bill C-17, had not as yet come into force because the coming into force of various provisions and of the regulations was staggered. So all of the provisions of C-17 had not come into force, and those that had been in force for such a short time that the effectiveness of these new provisions could not be adequately and accurately measured. Bill C-68 brought sweeping changes to Canada's gun control policy. 97 years after the first criminal code provisions on firearms was first adopted in 1892, and 51 years after the scrapping of the first mandatory long gun registration, long guns would once again be subject to mandatory registration. This legislation replaced the Firearms Acquisition Certificate System, FAC, with a system of POL, Possession Only Licenses, and PAL, Possession and Acquisition Licenses. And as I said, shotguns and rifles would now again be required to be registered, as had handguns since 1934, and as had the rifles and shotguns from 39 to 44, thereabouts. And finally, instead of the RCMP commissioner remaining as the depository and record keeper of the centralized universal registry, Bill C-68 gave this authority to the Department of Justice. Go figure. Before describing some basic fundamental principles that determine whether public policy will be good or bad, I want to provide you with just a couple of little known facts, or at least they were not known to me. If they were to you, then you were ahead of the game. You probably all know that to purchase and possess a firearm in Canada, the minimum age is 18 years. What you may not be aware of, and I certainly wasn't before beginning this research, and this is notwithstanding the fact I was critic of justice, liberal critic for justice, I took part in a long process within our own caucus of how we could deal with the opposition to the long gun registry, propose certain policy changes that would get buy-in from those who supported, like the Coalition for Gun Control, and for those who were opposing the long gun registry. I was not aware of these facts. First, minors aged 12 to 17 may procure what's called a minor's license. That license permits the minors to legally purchase ammunition, and it also permits the minor to be in possession, to borrow and use a firearm without any supervision. And there's another exemption for children under the age of 12. Children under the age of 12 can also get the exemption and get a minor's license if it can be demonstrated that the child needs to hunt and or trap. I was not aware of that. So there you have it in a nutshell, a very concise, brief history of gun control policy in Canada. But I forgot to mention, in 2006, the newly elected Conservative government announced a one-year amnesty for anyone who had not registered his or her non-restricted firearm. That means a long gun. And every year since then, the Conservative government has extended that amnesty. Now I want to share with you very briefly some basic principles of good public policy. Water is great. Most experts who have conducted serious studies on what makes for good public policy would be in agreement with the following statement. In making public policy, the policy itself and its delivery must go hand in hand. That a separation of these two elements can present a real obstacle to the policy being good. Remember the Firearm Act of 1995 transferred the authority of depository and record keeping from the commissioner of the RCMP to the Department of Justice. This meant that an organization, law enforcement, that deals with firearms on a daily basis, that had been the record keeper of the then existing registry since 1934, it existed since 1934, but it was centralized in 51. Excuse me, since 1951, was suddenly seen stripped of that authority and it was handed over to the Department of Justice, which had no experience with that. So keep that in mind. We're talking about good public policy and the fact that the two elements have to go hand in hand. Otherwise, it could represent an obstacle to the policy ending up being good. Public policy making, to quote Richard Curtin, and I quote, is about determining objectives or societal goals, which refers to big ticket issues such as how to promote internal social cohesion or how to best meet citizens' needs during major life cycle changes. Well, Canada and its people are going through a major life cycle change right now. When you go to the business section or to the life sections of the newspaper or you go to any media, they're talking about how the overwhelming majority of Canadians do not have a private pension. They will have to rely on the Canada Pension Plan if they manage to work and contribute, or if they did not work and therefore will not have Canada Pension Plan, CPP, they will have to rely on old age security and the guaranteed income supplement. That's a major life cycle change. And that's one that our governments are only now starting to talk about and starting to look at how they can deal with it. Well, part of whatever public policy they come up with, they have to be consulting with those who are going to be affected by those policies. Those of us who are already at the verge of retiring, those who have just retired, and those who will be retiring in the coming decade, two decades, and so on. There is also agreement that good public policy has to achieve its stated goal in order for it to be deemed good, and it must also be efficient by achieving the greatest possible benefit at the least possible cost. Good public policy also needs to be outcome focused and needs to ensure that the stated policy takes full account of the needs and experience of all those likely to be affected by the policy. This means a substantive and substantial consultation of those stakeholders, whether they be individuals, groups, families, etc. The government has to undertake substantive consultation with these individuals, groups, or families. Meaningful consultations of those who are the target of the policy must also form an integral part of the process of policy development. The government should not rely solely on the advice or views of experts. and those who will be charged with the implementation of any policy. It has to reach out to those who are going to be affected by the policy. I have found, both through my personal research on the issue of gun control in Canada and from my experience as 14 years as a Member of Parliament, that virtually all good public policy begins with an initial consultation, which then moves to a discussion paper on the issue, and that discussion paper outlines possible solutions. The purpose of the discussion paper is to define what might represent an effective and efficient public policy, like gun control, and also provide a believable, a reasonable, and accurate assessment of the benefits, the risks, and the costs to society if the existing policy is left status quo, no change whatsoever. But it also needs to provide the same assessment of benefits, risks, and costs of any change that's being proposed. And in the consultation process, the government should be seeking independent sources of policy advice, and it should also be establishing diverse ways to seek input from a wide range of stakeholders, including a cross-section of ordinary citizens. The government should also be providing public funding, which is accessible to those independent sources of policy advice, so that they don't have to rely on whatever the process is that the government puts into place. They will have the means in order to put into place their own consultation with their base and to reach out to people. Government must as well make readily available long-term research and evaluation of the existing policy that has informed the discussion paper, which outlines possible solutions. And given this age of overlapping policy boundaries, think cross-jurisdiction, federal-provincial, provincial-municipal, provincial-federal. That cross-jurisdiction exists in so many policy areas. Any effective policy development process must necessarily involve information sharing and collaboration between the jurisdictions. And finally, good public policy carefully focuses on the identification of how the policy will deliver the desired changes in the real world, not off in some imaginary world, but actually in the real world. It has to take into full account the needs and the experience of those likely to be affected by the changes in the policy. It should also be, as I mentioned before, outcome focused, and therefore must, in its development, have given the end users ample opportunity to participate in a variety of ways. And now I'm going to move to describing the Liberal government's process to develop its policy on gun control, which resulted in the Firearms Act of 1995. So go back to December 8, 1989, the tragedy of Polytechnique. The progressive conservative government acted quite quickly, as I mentioned, and I described the Bill C-17 that they brought in. I ask you to keep in your mind as well the fact that most of the provisions of C-17 had not yet come into force, when the Liberals came to power, and not even when they had tabled their own legislation. So in the November 1993, the Liberal Party of Canada wins the general election, forms majority government under the leadership of the Right Honourable Jean Chrétien. 6 months later, at the Liberal Party's National Biennial Policy Convention, Prime Minister Chrétien made a statement at the closing of the convention, thanking the National Liberal Women's Commission for, as he described it, its excellent policy resolution on strengthening gun control legislation or firearms legislation. And Mr. Chrétien, in his closing remarks, also stated he was going to ask his Minister of Justice, the Honourable Alan Rock, to draft, and I quote, tough gun control legislation. Less than 6 months later, Minister Rock released a document entitled Action Plan on Firearm Control. And within a very minuscule time, tabled in the House of Commons, Bill C-68, the Firearms Act, which created universal registration for all firearms with minimum mandatory penalties for convictions, violations of those provisions. This bill, according to the procedure of the House, was adopted at first reading. There's no debate on first reading. Bill is tabled, it's moved by whoever's tabling it, it's seconded, and it's automatically adopted. And then it goes on to the order of precedence, and whoever moved it, if it's a government bill, the government chooses when it's going to move second reading. And that's why when you saw with the conservative government, what we've seen is they brought in legislation, tabled it, and then never moved second reading, used the time to hammer the opposition for so-called holding up legislation when it's actually the government doing it. And I would not be surprised if the same thing happened under Liberals, because in many cases, conservatives have not invented anything. They've just taken it to a bigger extreme. So, on February 16th, 1994, so you're talking about the House sat for a very short period of time. The election was in 1993, the end of November. In November of 94, Alan Rock tables the action plan and then almost immediately tables Bill C-68. The House then adjourns for Christmas. When the Parliament adjourns, it adjourns for 6 weeks for the Christmas break, which means Parliament only came back at the end of January or the beginning of February 1994. And he moved second reading of Bill C-68. He stated in his speech that the bill had an overarching objective, and that was the preservation of the safe, civilized, and peaceful nature of Canada, and that to achieve this objective, three principles would be the guide. To quote part of his speech, "We do not wish to live in a country in which people feel they want or need to possess a firearm for protection. This is the first principle we take as a guiding principle for the preparation of legislation in terms of regulation of firearms. A second principle," and I'm still quoting him, "is that we should signal in every way possible that we will not tolerate and we will severely punish the use of firearms in the commission of a crime. A third principle is that we must acknowledge and recognize the legitimate uses of firearms, the use of firearms for ranching and hunting purposes, where firearms are a tool, an implement used by the proprietor of business to get by. We must allow for that. We must not interfere with that unduly," end quote. I read virtually all of the transcript, the Hansard transcript of the second and third reading debates on Bill C-68. And there are a couple of points that just kept hitting me over and over again. With regards to the Liberal process of public policy development and policy making on gun control, the first is that there appears to have been little or no consultation before the action plan came out. And between the time of the action plan, which should have formed the basis of then a real structured campaign of consultation, the government tabled the bill with the amendments. That kept hitting me in the face over and over again, and I'm saying, but that goes completely against what everybody who studied good policy development and good policy making have said should be done. One, it seems that the consultative process actually took place after the bill was tabled, when opposition began to rise. And even more consultation took place when the implementation began to run into real problems and cost overruns. And then suddenly There was a process that was put into place to really try and reach out and consult with the law enforcement down from the municipal police forces, small, medium-sized, large forces, to the provincial, to our national, the RCMP, to organizations that work on gun control in favor, opposed, you name it. It would also appear that the proposed stricter penalties or sentences for the use of firearms in the commission of a criminal offense received almost universal support among parliamentarians and the general public, including those people who would be affected by any changes to the registration system, the firearm owners of rifles and shotguns. That kind of widespread support was also evident, as I mentioned, for the proposed mandatory minimum sentences for the strict new penalties for illegal importation and trafficking of firearms, and for the permit requirements for the import, export, and in-transit shipment of firearms within Canada. Many MPs who took part in this debate underlined the fact that C-17, the precursor to C-68, had yet to be fully implemented, and therefore it was virtually impossible to determine the effectiveness of C-17 provisions. They argued unsuccessfully that the government, prior to proceeding with a mandatory universal firearm registry, should allow for full implementation of the C-17 regulations and provisions so as to properly determine its effectiveness and its efficiency. Government wasn't interested. So then the opposition members, and not a few liberal members as well, recommended that the government split the bill into two. One bill, two separate bills. One bill would contain the provisions of the mandatory minimum penalties, the stiffer sentences on the illegal importations, etc., all of which had virtually universal support. And the second bill would deal with the more contentious universal firearm registry. The government refused this compromise and instead used its majority to push through Bill C-68 and to ensure its adoption by both houses. Fast forward a couple of years, and we have now arrived at the cost overruns of the government's inept attempts through the Department of Justice to actually create a centralized universal firearm registry. It was predicted by government officials to cost only a few million dollars to implement and then to operate. By opponents, it was predicted to cost a minimum of $500 million. And at the time, the government poo-pooed the estimates of the opponents. The Auditor General finally pegged the real cost at $1 billion. The Auditor General also concluded that the Liberal government had misled Parliament twice about overspending at the Firearms Canada Firearms Centre. Does this sound familiar to anybody? June 2011, the Auditor General comes out with a report on the G8, G20 spending. Parliament approved spending of the Border Infrastructure Fund to beef up security in attente because of the summits that were going to happen. Monies were siphoned off into another fund called the G8 Legacy Fund that just happened to fund all kinds of vanity projects in Tony Clement's riding. Well, the Auditor General said that the Conservative government misled the House as to how it was actually going to spend the money. In the same way that they said the Liberal government had misled the House or Parliament on how it had overspent on its firearm legislation, the implementation thereof. Okay, I'm now at my conclusion. I've got lots of statistics, but I'm not going to bore you with that. If you have questions and I can use them, then I'll take them out and hope to, blind you with my brilliance. I am certain that many of you have been yearning for me to end this lecture. I'm delighted because I know I'm almost at the end and I'm starting to get weary of hearing my own voice. Here are some lessons that I hope any future government would heed should that government decide that new measures are required to strengthen whatever our gun control law and policy is at that time. And I'm presuming that the Conservatives do in fact abolish the long gun registration, maintain the registry for handguns. I'm also assuming that the Conservatives are also successful in destroying the data. The courts may prove me wrong, but I'm going on the most negative premise. So, the first thing I would advise any government who's thinking of looking at gun control again as a public policy is that that government should actually conduct comparative research as to what is the state of effectiveness with the gun control policies at that time. Compare it to the studies that were done before when we had universal firearm registration, meaning that long guns were included. And then compare it as well to what research we had about the effectiveness of firearm gun control policies before the long gun registration began in 1995 going forward. Do that comparative study to determine which appears to be the most effective, which appears to give the most bang for the buck, actually makes people safer, actually helps law enforcement do its job in a more effective and efficient fashion. Excuse me. It should also do such, secondly, if the evidence is fairly clear and convincing that the existing laws are not as effective as the previous, meaning not having long guns included in the registry makes for less effective gun control, people are not as safe than they were when they were included, then the government should develop a white paper on the issue, but it should also develop a major campaign of public education so that people actually understand that information, so that they have a solid base from which they can then look at the existing policy and determine whether or not they want it changed, and if they do, whether the costs inherent to that change are worth whatever the benefits would be. And the government should establish that consultation with the objective of establishing whether there exist solutions to whatever issues or problems have been shown to exist through the research, and also whether there's buy-in to proposed solutions. Thirdly, if reasonable solutions do appear, the government must properly cost them, and it must determine whether or not there's clear public support across the board for bearing those costs. The government also has to ensure that there are clear checks and balances to ensure that the costs are kept under control. That will be paramount given the predilection of both the previous progressive conservative governments, liberal governments, and now conservative governments to either mislead Parliament or to overspend or to mislead Parliament and overspend about the costs of programs and policies or about how monies have been spent. Your money, my money. We pay taxes. The government doesn't generate any taxes on its own. It gets its revenue from taxes, and that comes from ordinary people who work hard for their money. And so we have a right to know that our money is being spent well. That's the agreement. That's the compact, that we allow for a taxation system because we entrust the government to spend it wisely. So the checks and balances, ensuring the costs are kept under control, is also super important. Fourthly, the government should then go back to the public, and especially those who will be directly impacted by the proposed policy change, and evaluate the level of support or opposition and the depth of that support or opposition for the proposed changes. And finally, any future government has to listen actively to what it's being told by every viewpoint. It has to not exhibit an insensitivity to the preoccupations to the citizens who will be directly impacted by policy changes that are being proposed. Time and time again, studies have demonstrated very clearly that the more people feel that they were part of the process of developing a policy and part of the process of making the decision as to which changes should be implemented, the more people will have a vested interest in ensuring that the policy is successfully implemented. And allow me to conclude my remarks by saying that I hope it's been interesting and informative to you here. I hope that some of you have at least learned one or two new things that you didn't know before. And finally, I hope that the current governments are actually listening, whether they be federal, provincial, territorial, or municipal, and that they consider some of my advice worthy of serious consideration, because I know that some of the provincial governments are talking about setting up their own long gun registry. So if they do so, I hope that they actually follow principles of good public policy process development and good public policy decision making. Thank you all.
Madame Jennings has gentiment consenti à répondre aux questions. Well, I haven't actually asked you that, but you will take some questions. I invite you now to pose questions.
No questions? Great.
Yes.
Il veut l'enregistrer. Alors, il y a un micro là-bas et il y a un autre là-bas. Merci.
Alors, si vous avez une question, I have a question.
En fait, c'est plutôt un commentaire. Mon nom est France Houle, je suis professeure à la Faculté de droit de l'Université de Montréal. Et je travaille beaucoup sur les transformations du processus réglementaire, justement, au niveau du gouvernement fédéral. Et depuis maintenant, depuis 1986, le gouvernement fédéral a institué une politique administrative de consultation lorsqu'il y a des changements au règlement. Cette politique de consultation-là devrait impliquer une consultation au niveau de l'élaboration du règlement et une consultation une fois qu'il y a un projet de règlement qui a été publié dans la Gazette. Or, ce qu'on peut observer, c'est qu'effectivement, il y a une publication du projet de règlement avec un document qui s'appelle le résumé d'études d'impact de la réglementation, mais on a le résumé. On ne peut pas avoir accès à l'étude d'impact qui a véritablement servi à faire le règlement, s'il y en a eu, et on n'a pas accès à ça. Alors, la première chose, au niveau des politiques, si on veut que le public puisse véritablement exercer une surveillance sur le processus réglementaire, en l'occurrence, mais il faudrait qu'on ait accès à cette information-là et modifier la loi sur l'accès à l'information. C'est mon premier point. Le deuxième point qui est important, c'est que les cours de justice, depuis toujours, disent « Ah, nous, notre rôle n'est pas de s'impliquer dans le processus réglementaire, le processus législatif, et ce n'est pas à nous de mettre les pieds là-dedans, donc on ne s'en mêle pas. » Alors, aujourd'hui, quand on voit comment le privé est impliqué dans les processus législatifs, dans la réglementation, dans la gouvernance, on peut se poser la question, est-ce qu'il y aurait un rôle aujourd'hui à jouer pour les cours de justice pour vérifier certains aspects du processus consultatif? Peut-être pas la substance, mais peut-être juste la procédure, pour qu'il y ait un droit de regard sur ce que fait le gouvernement, voire justement, nous, en tant que citoyens, exercer une surveillance sur nos gouvernements à cet égard.
Merci beaucoup. Je vais répondre en français et je vais faire un court résumé en anglais par la suite pour ceux et celles qui ne sont pas si familiers avec le français. Vous avez entièrement d'accord sur la question d'avoir accès aux études qui ont formé la base ou la raison d'être d'un changement de réglementation ou de loi. J'ai siégé sur le comité mixte d'examen de la réglementation. C'était le seul comité de la Chambre et du Sénat, c'est mixte, qui avait un droit de regard sur la réglementation gouvernementale. Et maintes fois, nous, on demandait où sont les études sous-jacentes à ce règlement, et on avait beaucoup de misère à les obtenir. Alors, je pense qu'un changement ou une modification à la loi d'accès à l'information s'impose. I'm all for open government. Je pense que, sauf dans le cas de la sécurité nationale bien définie et encadrée, la plupart des choses devraient être accessibles au grand public. Sur la question de est-ce que les cours de justice devraient participer dans le processus d'élaboration de la réglementation, je pense que oui. Il y a des façons de le faire. Il y a le Conseil de la magistrature qui pourrait être demandé de faire des sondages hautement confidentiels où le nom des juges ne seront pas identifiés, ou les employés qui travaillent, toute l'administration autour de le fonctionnement d'un cours devrait être sondé également pour voir est-ce qu'un tel changement facilitera, rendrait plus efficace, plus efficiente le travail, de un. Deuxièmement, je pense qu'on devrait miser davantage sur des projets pilotes. Lorsque le gouvernement entame des projets pilotes dans le droit, que ce soit au niveau criminel ou au cours de la famille, par exemple, la plupart du temps, ça leur permet de roder les changements, de voir est-ce que ça fonctionne, qu'est-ce qui devrait être changé, etc., avant de le rendre applicable à tous les cours. Alors, je pense que vous avez soulevé deux bons points et je suis d'accord sur les deux. I've just said that I believe that we should have open government. And open government means that government studies conducted by their own bureaucrats or conducted under contract to the government, scientific studies, research studies, anything that forms the basis of the government proposing a legislative or regulatory change should be accessible to the public. And if it requires an amendment to the access to information law, then so be it, let's do it. That's the first thing. Secondly, whether or not courts of justice should participate or should be consulted when the government is contemplating a regulatory change or a legislative change that could impact on the functioning of that court. And I say yes. And there are ways to do it that will not impede on the independence of the judiciary. And the government can certainly use that and work in collaboration. And they can also think about doing pilot projects because those have proven to be very effective in allowing the government to evaluate whether or not a proposed change will be effective, will be efficient, and will work. Thank you. Merci.
Ms. Jennings, you have very strongly articulated the position that good public policy requires proper research, consultation, and accountability of implementation. Ideally speaking, you're right, but we don't live in an ideal world. If we are to use those criteria, then every single policy by the government is a failure. Health, education, Indian affairs, crime, justice, agriculture, every one single policy and subsection of the government would fail your criteria. So my question is, what's plan B?
Actually, I don't agree with you. I think that our governments can point to, and ordinary citizens can point to, public policy which is actually very good.
Like what?
Oh, Canada Pension Plan.
I'm sure there are lots of pensioners who wouldn't agree with you.
I think that most pensioners are happy that there is a Canada pension plan. Now, whether or not it's sufficiently funded, it's actually viable and sustainable thanks to changes that were taken through a consultative process that actually followed what most experts say is a good process. And Canada, for years, was considered a leader in terms of developing good public policy and establishing the process as to how to get there. We've not always listened to our own selves. So I don't believe that there needs to be a plan B. I do agree, however, that all too often governments, including the federal government, including liberal federal governments, have acted on issues. They've been reactive. There's been a situation. It appears to be a crisis. My God, we have to do something, and they do it. And you're basically juggling balls in the wall and gambling that it'll all land well. Sometimes it has, sometimes it has not. I can give you an example of a public policy where there was consultation. It went through. Then the implementation was not as good as it could be. And for the second phase, that too was corrected. And that's the homelessness initiative. And every single community person that works with the homeless has said that that policy, which was a federal government policy, was excellent.
That's why we have all these homeless people all around this area.
Hi there, Ms. Jennings.
Yes, hi.
So it seems to me that the current Conservative government's main grievance with the long gun registry, at least the current one that we have right now, is not necessarily the effectiveness of it, but more or less the principle. And what I mean to say is that, you know, we can try our best to register all the guns that are currently here, but how good is the policy in prohibiting guns from entering our country? And point being, we all know how great Steve's government has been at being transparent. That was sarcastic. but in any case, do you have any thoughts, and is there any relevant data that you could bring to mind?
You know, you raise a really good point. How good was the Firearms Act 1995 in terms of stopping illegal importation or smuggling, trafficking of firearms into Canada? Not that great. Okay? One of the things that law enforcement consistently, when I was parliamentary secretary to the Solicitor General, one of the things that they were asking for was certain legislative changes that would have actually given them a better tools in which to fight against the trafficking and illegal importation of firearms into Canada. That's the first thing. One of them was actually tracking numbers on ammunition and on firearms and that. So that was one. We didn't move on it. Mr. Harper certainly hasn't since he came to power. The other thing is that we didn't necessarily do the kind of research that should have been done. So for instance, I want to, you know, punch somebody when I read in the paper, and this is entirely true, that right now the way in which statistics are gathered on crimes that are committed with firearms in Canada, and it was true under Liberals, and it's still true now, that they are not collected in a way to be able to determine whether or not the crime which was committed with a firearm, whether or not the person who committed the crime had the appropriate license and permit to have a firearm, one, and if they didn't, was that firearm properly licensed, but it was stolen, and if that's the case, can they trace it back? We're not able to give that information. That's a real problem. Pardon? No, and I've seen the data, and we've had the people from Juristats of the section of Stats Canada come to us when I sat on the Justice Committee and tried to get information from them, and they weren't able to give the information because it doesn't come to them. There hasn't been agreement amongst the provinces and the federal government and law enforcement to include certain data on the information that gets reported and gets part of the depository, and then Stats Canada and Juristats can actually look at it and make these extrapolations. So, for instance, the issue of the number of firearm-related homicides, the issue of firearm-related suicides, it wasn't the federal government, through the data keeping, that was able to provide the information as to whether or not Bill C-68 had a positive effect. It was a master's student at Université de Montréal, Gagné, who did a research, and before he had just defended his thesis, came before Justice Committee with the results of his research, and he had been actually able to demonstrate clear scientific evidence that Bill C-68 helped reduce by 50 the number of firearm-related homicides every year per 100,000, and by 250 per 100,000 the number of firearm-related suicides. But the Liberal government wasn't able to provide that kind of information because they weren't tracking it. I get really angry because we didn't do our job, and we literally opened the doors, unlocked the doors, opened the doors, unlocked the windows, unclogged the chimney to allow all of the opponents of gun control and a universal firearm registry to come in and to be able to build support so that when conservatives came in, most people are saying, well, it's gone. You know, there's no point in fighting for it. It wasn't really effective to begin with. And that's because we, as a Liberal government, didn't do our job.
Okay, I think
thanks. And I'm getting dry mouth.
All right. Well, my first question was actually regarding statistics, which was if you knew sort of how many crimes were committed with long guns in Canada. And then my next part of the question was really, do you think that if we do re-implement the long gun registry, should it fall under the jurisdiction, again, of the Ministry of Justice, or should it go back to the RCMP?
Well, I'm happy to say that one of the things that Liberals actually did was to transfer it back to the RCMP. Okay. So that was excellent. And that's when the costs began to come under control and an actual workable universal registry actually began to be implemented. So that was a good thing. There are statistics on the number of homicide-related, firearm-related homicides. There is that information. Where the information was lacking was the registration. Whether or not they had been registered, we have the statistics as to, for instance, there has been a drop in the number of conjugal homicides that are firearm-related, the percentage that were long guns, that has gone down significantly under Bill C-68. But there's a lot more information that would demonstrate the effectiveness of that registry, the existence of the registry, that were not undertaken by the government or were not subsidized, funded by the government.
Thank you.
You're too kind. Thank you, Honorable Jennings. I learned more about Canadian gun control policy than I thought I'd ever know. My question actually concerns, it's more cultural, so it's a little different question. As an American, I find debates on gun control in Canada fascinating because your country seems closer to some sort of systematic gun control than America is. So I was wondering if you could comment on what cultural factors in Canada seem to make gun control easier in Canada than it is in America, if there's any. Thanks.
That's a big, tall order. I'll be very brief, and this is my personal experience. And that is that one of the things that makes Canada a less contentious country, in the sense that when we look historically, we attempt to actually sit down and talk to each other and arrive at a consensus, even when we start from opposing viewpoints. I put that down to the actual development and populating of our country. It's a diverse country. We're bigger than the United States. in order to actually colonize and populate the country took enormous cooperation on the part of the explorers and then on the part of the les habitants. I mean, my great-grandparents on the maternal side were Belgian. They came to Canada under the Homesteaders Act. They were plunked down in Manitoba. They couldn't take it. They went back. But my grandmother, their daughter, stayed. She loved the frontier and the wilderness and the great expanses. But people were required to really work together. And we also began with, right from the get-go, with different nationalities, with different languages. And in order to decide to bring together a country and actually create a country, we had to develop a consensus. And so I think that on gun control, that those traits help develop the fact that we are, I believe, more advanced in many ways on gun control than many of the states are.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I was just wondering if you'd come across in your research any countries that you thought represented really good gun control policy. I know lots of European countries have really high rates of gun ownership, but not so much gun violence. So,
honestly, no, I did not focus my research on that. That would require then comparative, and no, I didn't. But it's a good subject for a further...
I'll ask one of our very best students.
On behalf of McGill Institute for the Study of Canada and the participants of this evening's event, The Anatomy of Good Public Policy Gone Bad, Canada's Gun Control Laws, I would like to sincerely thank Ms. Jennings for her very thoughtful and animated presentation. And I would like to thank you again for illustrating to us all the importance of public consultation and the formation of policies that inform our lives. So thank you, Marlene, and I hope that you will accept this gift from McGill Institute. So thank you.
Et je vous invite maintenant à prendre un verre dans la salle à côté. Please join us for a glass of refreshment in the room next door.